All right, time for part two of Jose Higueras here on Holding Court. You'll be happy to know, Jose, that my lesson went extremely well. I played with an older woman, and she just wants to learn, wants to get better. So that's what it's all about, right?
Not surprised about hearing that it went well. And as long as they want to learn, that's the fun of the whole deal.
You know, it's funny because, I want to transition into your RUSTA story, but more from your standpoint. But I guess when I first started working, especially with kids, I thought to myself, well, it's all about having fun. It's all about improving. And then I realized shortly after I started spending a lot of time on court that actually learning is the most important, isn't it? Because when kids, especially kids, but anybody, obviously this is a woman in her 70s who took the lesson from me today. When people want to learn, they enjoy things so much more, don't they?
Yeah, I will agree with that. I think getting better is about as much fun as you can have.
Yeah.
You know, and it makes you feel good. And if you're engaged, I mean, it's just so much more, there's so much more purpose, you know. And obviously, you don't have to run the lesson like a military drill or anything like that. But obviously, getting better, I think, is very, it feels good.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes kids kind of lack a little bit of that structure or that mindset, to be honest.
So one of the many reasons, of course, I talked about a little bit earlier that I thought you were the man for the job was because of your attitude, your experience, but also because you had what we call the coaching philosophy.
Right.
And while we knew that it was going to be difficult to implement that entirely around the country, we weren't really trying to do that, but within our own coaching staff at the USTA. So maybe start from that standpoint of about your philosophy and why we agreed that was an important part of our attempt to help American tennis.
Yes. Well, if I may say one step back,
sure.
Patrick, when you called me, I think it was March of 2008, I've known the USTA and I've been involved with the USTA for about 30 years on and off, but always as an independent contractor. And it was a reason for that. And the reason is that I've seen it through the years how there is so much change that is very difficult or impossible to actually get things done. So that's why it took me so long until October of that year that after Roger won the U.S. Open to make the decision to take the job, because I was assured that they were going to let us do what we were set to do with enough time, which is probably, as I told the board at the time, it was going to be between 10 and 12 years.
Right.
So once I got in, it was really nothing. The country in terms of our coaches' education, in terms of if you compare it with the world, we were way behind. And I remember me telling you, I said, Patrick, I can coach a player or two, but I cannot coach the whole country. So that's where it came about. While we sat down with all of us, and also we reached out to the private sector, spoke to coaches, spoke to ex-players, spoke to other people from other countries, and we put together a pretty simple guideline, you know, on how to. A way to give the kids a chance to become successful as they get older. So that's why we put together that teaching and coaching philosophy that, if you remember, for 3 years, we took it to all over the country, through all the sections. We made great inroads with our relationship with the private sector, which was non-existent at the time. And it wasn't easy, but I think that was a huge step. And actually at this point, I believe USPTA is collaborating with the USDA, with the coaches education, with the coaches education program, and the footprint of our philosophy is what is there. So I thought it was a huge thing, and it took us once again 3 years, tough years traveling all over the country, making relationships, talking to people, and that was the first step. And obviously our coaches at the time was were the priority, but we got some coaches also from out of the country. Once again, just get some perspective, you know, from different places that did things well. And I thought it was a success, to be honest. And we're still working with that.
So yeah, and interesting, because we took a lot of slings and arrows. Yours truly got most of them from, you know, trying to implement this from the private sector. And now that I'm in the private sector, I can see that side of it. You know, people thinking they know how to train players, which a lot of them do. And also from, as you said, on the coaching standpoint, but, you know, the sections also sort of run their own independent businesses, so to speak. So we ran into a lot of obstacles. I got a lot of heat because, you know, doing multiple things that I was doing, working on television and so on. So I think eventually that caught up to me in my role. But, you know, we were pretty strong about our belief that this should happen. And as you said, also the other thing people gave us a lot of crap about was hiring coaches from different parts of the world, which I think we thought was a smart thing to do because, you know, players are coming from all different parts of the world. And so that helped, I thought, educate our own coaches that were, whether they're foreign or American, and also the players that we were working with.
Yes, I mean, we encountered quite a bit of resistance at the beginning, but once again, it wasn't about telling people what to do. It was about just sharing a document that is alive still, and it's evolving with time. But it was pretty simple. It wasn't a very high performance coaching education. It was having some parameters and on how we teach the kids. So for example, why would we teach a kid to take the racket back on the forehand side with the racket below the hand? Well, how many players in the world that are good do that? None. So just some pretty simple parameters so we can actually agree on. And I think, after a few years, I'll tell you what, for me, that was one of the biggest achievements that we had, because the country came together, the culture started to change. And we saw those results 4 or 5 years on the road, which I thought it was what the time that it was going to take.
Now, fast forward to when I left the USTA, and I'll be honest now, since it's so many years removed from it, I don't know if I've ever told you exactly what happened with me. I'm not going to say I was fired, but I'm going to say that I probably would have been fired if I didn't decide that when the USTA made the decision to go to the Orlando, which I was a big part of, I think, helping create that situation and the training center. I think basically if I had said, no, I really want to go to Orlando, which I didn't want to do for a number of reasons, I probably would have been fired. I'm pretty sure I would have been. So, you know, there was sort of an agreement there between me and my bosses at the USTA that would be the best way to go. Obviously, I was getting a lot of heat from, you know, as I said, doing other things, and people felt, maybe rightly so, that I should be 100% focused on my job at the USTA. Right. Of course, I thought I was, and I thought having a different outlet in some ways actually helped me have a little bit more, not freedom is the wrong word, but maybe authority and not so beholden to just working for the USTA. But from your standpoint, how were you reading the tea leaves as, you know, we got deeper into this?
Well, I was devastated, to be honest. I remember when you called me and told me about the decision. I was visiting a friend of mine that was pretty sick in a couple of hours from New York. And I was pretty devastated because you know better than anybody the amount of work. I mean, I traveled 2 million miles doing that. And you know how much work. And I knew what was coming because I've seen it before. And that was why I was skeptical I was taking the job in the first place. So when that happened, 2 days later, I walked into Gordon Smith's office, which was our CEO, and I told him my fears. I said, Gordon, look where the program is. We were the envy of the world at the time with the girls and with the boys. And the work that we did the prior 5 years was starting to come up. So anyway, I went and relayed my concerns to him about the new person coming in, about being able to keep doing what we were doing. And then I actually called the president at the time, Patrick Galbraith, and I had a meeting with him at the Hyatt, and I told him exactly the same thing. And I told him that I wouldn't be very happy if that would happen. And but it happened. You know, change came. Change came with good intentions, and our program pretty much got dismantled. You know, our director of men got fired. we brought another guy that was an absolute disaster. The fans that were going to the juniors, because everything, our idea was to everything from the bottom up. They start with the sections, they start with the children, and then all the way up to give them a chance to be pros if they wanted to do that or go to college. That was the whole idea. But then the fans were taken away from that. They were taken away from Catholic education and went to the pros. That most of them or a lot of them were making enough money to actually subsidize their career, which is what they should do once they make enough money, because the resources should go for the younger kids. So the same thing happened with the sports science department. I'm going to tell you, when we were doing that with Dr. Lovers, we had 2,000 coaches going to the high performance coaching program, and another 5,000 that we did through the sections, you know, with the camps that we did in the sections, and then and also at the national center. So basically, that was the change that I was fearing, and that's exactly what happened.
Let me play devil's advocate, since I'm supposed to be sort of a pseudo journalist doing my own podcast.
Yes.
But I'll attack myself. Why not? So I'll say, well, that's all well and good, but where are the players? You know, because this is what I hear right in my job at ESPN and over the years. So obviously, we the United States has had many top female players, but and we've got some good young American male players, but nobody at the top. So if I'm someone from the outside, I'm saying, what's this guy talking about? They had such a great program. Where are all the great players? How do you respond to that?
I'll respond very easily. You cannot, in my opinion, you cannot have a program to develop Grand Slam champions. The Grand Slam champions come. You can have a program and have everything in place to facilitate that, the development of somebody that has what it takes in terms of talent and mental toughness and athleticism and so on to become a world champion. So, but everything starts from the beginning. And we started from the beginning right. In 2017, I believe it was, we had our juniors won the French Open, champion and runner-up, Wimbledon, champion and runner-up, U.S. Open, champion and runner-up. And then Stefan Kozlov won the Australian Open and beat Zverev 0-1. Okay, so everything starts from the beginning. You don't plant a tree, a two-foot, tall tree, and expect to get two tons of fruit the first year. So the base was set for that, and that was something that. So if you look at the players that we have now, those are the kids that we started. Radio Pelka, Tommy Paul, and also working with some of these like Francis. We had a great relationship with JTCC up in Maryland with Taylor Fritz. You know that his dad was the one that started him in coaching and everything. So It wasn't all us, but we had a great. We were the envy of the world. And another thing, you know, people talk about diversity. I mean, the women, the success of the women in this country has been pretty much overlooked.
Mm-hmm.
We've been doing unbelievable. So my point is, our boys. I mean, those boys. If you look at the history of the juniors, if you become a top or the best junior in the world, your chances of becoming a good player are pretty good. Now, that doesn't mean you're going to win slams, because it takes more than that.
Right.
So our base was, you know, was great. Now, when at the time we used to work with 90% of the players, men and women. Do you know how many we're working now with?
How many?
Not too many. Not too many or none.
And why do you think that is? You mean, are you talking about the professional players or the players are kind of breaking through?
No, the professionals. I mean. Mm-hmm. Then what happened when that change happened, we lost a lot of our good coaches that are actually working now with our best prospects. So basically, we lost about 200 years of experience. And, wow. And as you know, you don't become a coach from one day to the other. You can read all the books you like. I mean, you need the hours on course and experience. So I thought we were in a great place. Like, I think we are in a great place now again. For example, you have our... this group of boys, you know, with Riley and Francis and Tommy and all these boys, that were better than Zverev and Tim and all that group. But the difference was because I believe these guys are as good as all those guys, to be honest with you. I really do. Because they work better. But they kinda, and it happens at times, you know, where you're young, you touch a little fame, touch a little money. So they stopped doing what we were doing, basically. But in the last 2 years, year and a half, they came back to actually do what the professionals do. And they are catching up. And I believe we're going to see some really good things from some of these guys, to be honest with you. So basically, the structure, I mean, basically, Martin, when we were running the program, and when I was running the program on what I was doing, and you were doing, sports is a meritocracy. Right. You don't advance if you don't win, right? Where the USDA is not.
So that's, in your opinion, the biggest thing that's changed since I left, or since you've kind of moved on.
100%.
Yeah. Okay.
So in 2018, I was going to quit. Mm-hmm. I mean, actually, I still had another year or 2 years under my contract, but seeing how the situation was going, I was going to quit. I talked to Ola, and I said, Ola, you should take a job because they need somebody. You know Ola as well as I do. I think he's great. I think he's an extremely capable coach and got a great tennis mind and well organized. And he said, Jose, I will not take the job if you leave. So anyway, we came to terms and we kind of went back again to what we were doing before. And actually, we have a really good group of boys coming up again, 14-year-olds. So once again, everything started, but we wasted 4 years. Almost 5 years where we neglected six or seven age groups.
Yeah, I find, and I've kept my distance for the most part. I've obviously kept in touch with you and Ola Momquist, by the way, who's the director of coaching now for the USTA. Yeah. I only have one correction to make to you, Jose. I think Kozlov lost in the final of the Australian Open Juniors to Zverev, but anyway, he won the Orange Bowl, played Tiafo, as we remember, in the final. So I get your overall point, yeah. But I think what's happened is, and this is always very tricky because, you know, when you take over the role and I love Martin Blackman who's taken over.
So do I.
And, you know, he worked for us when we were first starting out and we roomed together at Stanford. I have a lot of respect for him, but in some instances, your hands are tied a little bit. And I think some of the direction that the USTA decided to go were financial reasons, cutting the budgets of the sections. And even this was even pre-COVID. So that is, you know, I sort of get, but I do think that where Martin went a little bit astray, and you just said it to me, so that's why I bring it up, is saying yes to a lot of people. And, you know, one of the things that I did, which got me, you know, a lot of people pissed off at me, was not say yes. You know, whether it's to certain players, like you said, I always felt that the players that made it on the tour we could help them as the USTA if they wanted help, but we shouldn't be, you know, supplying them with full-time coaches and giving them money, which is what a lot of players ask for. And so when you say no to them or ex great players, for example, you and I know some stories there that we won't divulge on this podcast of certain players that, you know, just ask for a huge amount of money. And so it was my job to say no to a lot of those people. Yeah. And I think maybe Martin went the other direction too early in saying yes to a lot of people. And then you lose that meritocracy that you're talking about. So I'm glad to hear that you think it's coming back. And what do you think it's going to take again for a U.S. male player? Because again, I'm going to look at this from 60,000 feet. I mean, I know my answer to this. Your answer to what's it going to take for a U.S. male player to win a major tournament?
You know, once again, I think this group of guys. We have a good group of players. And I'm going to name some of them. You have Tommy Paul. You have Riley Opelka. You have Taylor Fritz. You have Francis Tiafoe, you have Jason Brooksby, you have Brandon Nakajima,
Sebastian Korda.
I mean, we are in a good place if we actually let things play out, but we have to keep working on the bottom. So actually, we don't have a hole. And because once again, Martin, I cannot guarantee you can give me all the money in the world. I cannot guarantee you I'm going to get a Grand Slam champion in 5 years. But I guarantee you, I have a bunch of good players.
Right, and that was really our goal from the start, wasn't it? Because I think we knew that going in.
Yes. So basically, from what I see, these guys are catching up. They really are. And I think they're going to surprise some people. You know, so what is it going to take? It's going to take a little more confidence. It's going to take maybe a little more work, the way they've been doing it for the last year and a half or 2 years. And I believe they are as good as the other guys. So, but once again, but you got to keep feeding that system. Mm, mm-hmm. And we have the resources to do that. Now, from what you said before, you know, change is coming again. I mean, change is coming again. We got a new CEO that all of a sudden, player development is under community tennis. Mm-hmm. I mean, have you ever seen anywhere in the world that the high performance program is under the community program?
No, I have not.
I haven't. So I don't know exactly what the thought is, but change is coming again. And that's what is scary. You know, that's what is scary, because things are starting to fall in place again. In the last year, since Ola took the job, once again, if you look at Le Petit Ash, if you look at the young kids, we have a good group of boys coming up again, and girls. I mean, we have boys and girls. So the problem is that there is change. There is no continuity. And I will repeat it again. That was my hesitance about taking the job. Because when you take a job like that with a country as big as this country, it takes 10 to 12 years to actually see if what you're doing is working or not. And basically, the more, Patrick, I'll have some numbers here. So, for example, if you look at the girls, I'm going to read you some of the girls, and then I'm going to tell you how many we work with them. In the last 12 years, women in the top 100. You have, I don't have to go through all of them, but you have, you know, Sloane Stephens,
right.
Sonia Kenny, Madison Keys, Coco Vandeweghe, Collins, Jenny Brady, Coco, Jessica Pegula, Alison Ruiz, Barbara Lechenko, Anisimova, Christina McHale, Jamie Hampton, Lauren Davis, Bethany Marik. I mean, and the list goes on and on until 39. Okay, so out of those girls, of those ladies, we were full time or close with all except Coco Gauff, Jessica Pegula, Collins, and Burdett.
Mm-hmm.
So out of 37, we coached full time or close to full time, cooperating with their coaches depending on their needs, with 97% of the players. The same happened with the men. And that kind of shows you a little bit, it kind of shows you how the cooperation went with the private sector. I mean, you're not going to keep everybody happy. That's obvious. But those are the numbers, the same with the men, you know, with Murray Fish, Isner, Sock, Query, Opelka, Fish, Johnson, Tiafoe, Korda, Young, Harrison, Sangren, Paul, Donaldson, Baker, and so on and so on and so on. We work with everybody full time or very close to full time, except with John Isner, Brooksby, Crazy, Russell Nakajima, that I actually worked with him last year,
right,
and Odesnik. The rest of the players, we work with them full time or very close to that. And at this point, we don't work with anybody.
Interesting.
But a lot of our coaches are working. And the thing, Martin, Patrick, with player development, is that people don't know the story. People don't know the story because one thing that I was told when Dave Haggerty was president of the USDA was that PD could not take any credit for anything.
Right.
And so people think we just go and pretty much, scratch our head all day long. But this is somewhat a little bit of the work that was done during that time.
Listen, Jose, I mean, you don't need to tell me, but I appreciate all that you have done and I know will continue to do. And there's a lot more to, we could go on for hours and hours, and maybe we'll do part three and part four. I'm sure the insiders in the tennis world will love to hear this. I'll be interested once I put it out, which I will do very shortly. What the response is from people, but I appreciate you wanting to tell this part of the story and putting it out there. And like you said, it's a team effort. You know, and that was always our mission, in the taking credit part. I mean, I see it from my side now and working from our own academy. I have coaches here that work with me, work for me, whatever you want to say at the McEnroe Academy, that spend all this time with players, and they don't want the USTA to steal them and take them away. So I kind of see in both sides of it now, which, you know, I would even hopefully have done a better job if I had had that experience before, but I think that was always our mission. And people can argue, well, the USTA really didn't coach this player or whatever. At the end of the day, it doesn't really matter.
It doesn't. Patrick. And the thing is, you know, once again, you have some of the players that I'm mentioning here. You help people differently according to their needs.
Right.
We cannot coach everybody. If we don't want to coach everybody, if somebody has a good situation at home, why would we want to take that kid away from home? So you have the coach. We normally offer the players according to their situation. And I think the relationship, you take Sebastian Korda, for example. Well, Sebastian, you know, Peter, his dad, he started him and he always is extremely involved. But he gets like 25 weeks with Dean Goffin, which is a really, really, really good coach. Mm-hmm. And somebody else gets a certain conditioning guy, and somebody else gets some mental help, and somebody gets so once again, it's a team effort. It's not a USDA or PD effort. It's a country effort, and that's the only way to maximize. But I was just going to make one point, Patrick. The reason for me to come out and say all this, I have no, as you guys say, I have no doubt on this fight. My reason is we can do better. We have the resources to do better. We should have the best program in the world because we have the resources to do that. And I think once again, if we can come together and actually get somebody that you think can do the job and give them the time to do it. And that's the only thing that I'm kind of a little bit hurt is because of that, because I know the amount of work that we have put into the whole thing and then see that pretty much just washed. And start all over again, and all over again, and all over again. It's pretty frustrating. And I think our kids and our tennis community as a whole deserve better than that. And that comes from somebody that loves tennis. And once again, I am not looking for a job. Believe me, I'm already, I'm not a puppy anymore.
Well, listen, I'm going to be out there for the BNP Paribas Open. I expect Jose to treat me yet again to some of your world famous tequila. Out on your ranch, and thank you for agreeing to come on and tell your side of the story, and we will stay in touch, my friend.
Thank you, amigo. I appreciate it, Patrick.
Jose Higueras, everyone, on Holding Court.
Holding Court with Patrick McEnroe is powered by Mudhouse Media.